I like when like people eat stuff and they kind of like just get that stupid kind of little smile on their face and like a bit of a head nod, whether it be like pastries or sandwiches at Saga. Like, I just like seeing people enjoy stuff, whether I'm like cooking for other people or my family at home.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. We've talked a lot about great pastry, about vegan pastry and the art of desserts on Deep in the Weeds, but not a lot about cake. It's kind of relegated for the most part to a secondary level in the world of pastry, but should it be? What does it take to make a great cake? Andy Bowden is the owner of Andy Bowdy Pastry and co-owner of Saga in Enmore. Andy, how are you?
Hey, mate. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to get you on the show. You've made a huge name for yourself with cakes, although you do other things. What was that time like when there was that sort of explosion and interest in what you were doing?
It was really crazy. I guess when the cakes kind of took off, it was around the same time that Hearts Yard was going bonkers as well. So, I mean, Hearts Yard was full every night. I was doing lots of desserts for just a one-man pastry team. On top of that, I kind of just accidentally created this cake kind of style. Well, I don't know if I created it, but like I just kind of started making these cakes, and all of a sudden people were coming into the restaurant wanting these cakes. And at the time, I guess I had no set formula for what I was doing for cakes. People would just come and be like, can you make a cake? And then I'd spend, you know, 3 hours making a cake, 4 hours making a cake, and Greg would be like, hey, dude, you got prep to do for the restaurant as well. So I'd be there after hours just slogging away because I was so fascinated with making these cakes and going out and presenting them to customers in the restaurant.
Oh, take us back to that period. Do you have any stories of sort of the successes and failures of that sort of moment when you sort of really exploded with cakes?
I think for the most part, like, there weren't too many failures, which is always good when you're making cakes. I mean, in my life, I've had a few failures with cakes, like forgetting to put gelatin in mousses and kind of unwrapping them to decorate them when the customer's in the restaurant, and then, you know, having just a puddle of mousse pour out of acetate. It's never good, and you kind of have that moment of realization that you've massively fucked up and you need to like turn around and say to your head chef, like, chef, we've got a problem. Especially usually seeing like in restaurants like that I've worked in, like the majority of the cakes that I've made have usually just been for VIPs, because like as a pastry chef in a restaurant, like you've got other things to do besides standing around making cakes all day. So it's usually like we've got a VIP coming in, it's their birthday. Can you make them a cake? And you're like, sure, no worries. And when stuff like that goes wrong, it's still the greatest feeling in the world, because there's not a lot you can do apart from just stand there and look like an idiot and just resign yourself to the fact that chef's probably not going to talk to you for the next week. But yeah, Hearts Yard days was crazy. It just kind of started with one VIP. I mean, well, one regular customer coming in and asking for a birthday cake, and I did that, and I think, I don't know how it happened from there. Like, I think I posted it on Instagram. Back then, I'd only just got Instagram, and I'd only actually got it because Madison, my partner, had told me that it'd be a good thing to do. I was kind of like, what do I need that for? Like, I've already got Facebook. Like, what's the difference? And I did that, and it just kind of went from there. Like, one cake, two cakes, and then next thing you know, you've got people kind of calling up, requesting cakes, and you know, there was like Greg was kind of doing events for like kind of a couple of celebrity events, and then like I'd kind of like get asked to make a cake for like the event, and it just kind of steamrolled from there.
You mentioned that Hearts Yard was really booming at the same time as well. You were given a real license to sort of go for it in regards to pastry at Hearts Yard. Tell us about what it was like as a pastry chef there, and the foundation that you built to go on and do what you've done?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I probably wouldn't have got anywhere in life without Hearts Yard. I owe a lot of that to Greg and Nomi. I met Greg working at Wildfire together, and we just kind of really hit it off. We'd always have like kind of late night chats in the office about desserts and stuff like that, and Greg left and called me one day out of the blue and was just like, hey dude, I'm going to start a restaurant, I want you to come along. And at that time, I guess when I was working at Wildfire, I was kind of always under, anytime you wanted to do something, anytime you wanted to put a dessert on, you'd always have to like do plate ups, take it to the chefs, then you'd have to take it to the owners, and then they'd be like, yes, no, whatever. Whereas I said to Greg, I was just kind of like, can I just do what I want to do? And he was like, dude, I completely trust you too. I know what you do. And he was like, I mean, in saying that, like, it didn't mean like he always bought me the equipment I wanted. But like, we did we had the Hearts Yard Sunday, which, as you know, like, had a bit of a cult following, and I'd be selling, 40, 50 of them a day. Like we'd have people just come in after the restaurant was done. There'd some nights just be a whole turn of people just coming in for desserts. So back to the fact that Greg wouldn't always buy me the equipment that I wanted. I was using Cuisine Art ice cream machines that whole time, just the little benchtop ones. I was like, dude, come on, man. Like I just constantly have this thing just pounding away, churning ice cream like all day, every day. Because it's only a benchtop one, like a at-home one, I guess, and it just takes a lot longer. And I mean, like, in summertime, it would struggle so hard that I had to get an extension lead and put it in the cool room to keep yeah, so it was quite wild. But yeah, I mean, like, I came to Greg with the idea of the soft serves, and he was like, cool, go for it. That'll be great. Like, we had the pie of the week that just kind of started out of nothing. It was like, I think that started out of like trying to get rid of like things in the cool room that, you know, I need to get rid of some kind of fruit. So I made a pie, and then like it turned into like, I'll do it again next week, and then turned into pie of the week. So we had soft serve of the week, pie of the week. On top of that, all the desserts and then the cakes came along. So, and on top of that, Greg had a knack of like, basically every time he came up with a dish and needed something else to go on it, it turned out to be like a bread or a lavash or something like that. So I was quite a busy boy for a while.
I want to explore sort of what you've done since then. And you obviously have your own establishment now, Saga, as well in Enmore. But take me back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play for you in your family?
I think food was quite important. Like, I mean, I like to eat. I think that's where I often found myself in kitchens. And I don't know whether that's because I had an interest in cooking, or whether it's more because I like to eat. So my mum had a shop up in Lura. It was a kid's clothing store, and I used to go up there in the school holidays, but I used to hang out at the deli in Lura, and I just used to sit on the bench. Brad, the guy who owned the deli, would be making chocolate mud cakes, cheesecakes and stuff, and I'd just be sitting there kind of assisting cleaning the bowl when he was done with So, I mean, I always liked food, and memories of going to Nan's house my Nan used to make a chocolate mousse, and there was always this, you drive down to Goulburn, and the whole way down, all I would be thinking about was, I hope Nan's made chocolate mousse, because I'm going to be real devo if she hasn't. And I guess, like, you get to the back steps, and you run up the back steps, straight past Nan, straight to the fridge, open the fridge up, and you'd be like, sweet, sir, we're all good. But yeah, I mean, family gatherings, all that kind of food was very important. I guess the style of food is very different to like what I'm used to today, but like it was, I don't know, growing up, you kind of like, you have all these things that you love growing up, and then I feel like when you become a chef, you like learn how to make all these things properly, and you're kind of like, oh man, I was getting ripped off all this time, like, mum. Like for mashed potato, for example, like I used to love mashed potato growing up, but like then you have mashed potato in a restaurant, and then you realize that the lumpy stuff that your mum used to serve you growing up just doesn't cut it anymore. It's great to go back to for like nostalgia, but like now, like for me to make mash, like I just know how much effort's involved to get it to this standard that I kind of like am used to now. So like I barely make it. Yeah.
Did you always have thoughts of a career as a chef, or did you head in a different direction?
I briefly considered it. Like I never thought about leaving school to do it early. I had a private school education, so I guess the expectation was that you'd kind of finish that and then go to university. My mom had my little brother when I was maybe about 16, and at that point she was kind of like, she was working, she didn't want to come home and cook every night, so she'd like cook his food because he was obviously younger. So me and my sister were kind of like pushed into learning how to cook for ourselves. So I did kind of, not that she was a bad mother and she wasn't trying to cook for us, I'm not saying that, but like she was just kind of like, you know, I'm tired, you guys can fix yourself something for dinner, which was fine. And I guess from that, like I started teaching myself like kind of basics on how to cook stuff, and I kind of enjoyed that. But then I had a mate who left school to become a chef, and I heard how horrible the pay was and how long he was working, and I was just kind of like, oh, I'm not doing that. So I went to university twice. I went and did visual arts at Sydney College of the Arts, and that lasted a whole of a semester. Basically just because I'd left school and all I wanted to do was kind of party. So I wasn't very applied at that. had like a brief stint working in retail, and then kind of the parents were like, you need to do something, you need to go back to uni. So I signed up for a double degree in engineering, by which point my brain had all but failed me because of all the partying I've been doing. So I kind of went back to university, and the 18 hours of maths a week was just no good. Like, and I was just like, there's no way I'm going and getting myself a tutor at, you know, the age of 21. I'm not doing this. So went back to working in retail, saved up a bunch of money, and then I went on, you know, one of those I'm going to go overseas and discover myself trips, and just kind of fell my way into the kitchen. There was a job online. This was like just as Facebook was starting. So like, I think it was like, it wasn't Craigslist or something else, maybe Gumtree or something like that. There was like an ad that just said, want to be chefs. And I was like, yeah, I want to be a chef. So I just went for it. It's actually really horrible. I've never felt like so out of place. I thought, yeah, I can blag this. And then I remember the very first job I had in the kitchen. I got asked to pick lettuce, and I had no idea what that meant. Like, I had no experience in the kitchen, and they're thrown down three boxes of lettuce and said, pick this lettuce. And I was just like, what the fuck does pick lettuce mean? I was like, back home in Australia, this comes in a bag like a cold. What's going on? And I asked a few people around the kitchen, and they'd all told me to fuck off. And I was just kind of like, oh God, this can be rough. And luckily for me, a chef at one of the other restaurants that, the guy owned where I was working had just walked out, and he just kind of looked at me and said, "You go get changed, pack up your stuff, you can go to the other restaurant now." I was like, "Oh, thank God, got out of pizza and lettuce."
When did you find your feet in the kitchen? Do you have any stories of sort of when you realized, yeah, you can make a career of this?
I felt pretty confident. Like, I mean, there was like the first, you know, the first month was really shaky, but I feel like I put in a lot of time. Like, I didn't do an apprenticeship, so like I kind of like didn't have that to fall back on, like where I could go to school and get taught how to do stuff. And I'd kind of lied my way into the kitchen. So I felt like there was an expectation that everyone thought that I knew what I was doing. But I feel like I put in a lot of time early on. I'd stay back. I'd ask a lot of questions. Like, I used to go in early with the pastry chef so I could learn how to do that kind of stuff. I think I always stood out like a sore thumb early on. But, like, I was, you know, showing interest and putting in the work so I could learn how to do stuff so I wasn't such a burden on the team. I did that for a while, and then I feel like I came back to Australia and went for a few trials, which didn't really work out. I got back, and my mum was heaps proud of me that I'd gone and found a career in cooking, and she went and bought me some brand new knives. And as you know, like when you get a brand new knife, first thing you want to do is cut the end of your finger off. So I went for a trial over at a restaurant in Balmain, and they gave me a bag of onions and asked me to chop up the bag of onions. And within like, you know, 5 minutes, I was hand in the air asking for a Band-Aid. So that didn't work out. And then I went over for a trial at Pink Salt in Double Bay, where Michael Rantisi, Keppel Street Michael Rantisi, was the head chef at the time. And went for a trial there. The first thing he still reminds me of this to this day. The first thing he asked me to do was to make a brulee. Like, you know, when people go for a trial, you kind of like give them the basics to see if they have like a basic understanding of what's going on in the kitchen. And I was like, brulee, I can do that. Like, I know how to make a brulee. And obviously, in between flying back from London, I'd forgotten some key steps to making a brulee. And I'd cracked all the egg yolks and then took the pot over to the stove and put the egg yolks in the pot and proceeded to start cooking them. And he was just like, "What are you doing? Like, are you making scrambled eggs?" And I was like, I don't know, chef. But anyway, he gave me a job, which I don't know. I still don't know why he gave me a job. The other girl that came in for a trial must have been absolutely rubbish. So he ended up giving me the job. He was really good for my career. Like early on, I had kind of like a mentor, like one of his friends, an Israeli pastry chef who was working over at Bathers Pavilion at the time. He used to come over like once or twice a week and kind of show me things. And anytime I wanted to learn things, like Mike would send me to like talk to suppliers about chocolate or cheese or things like that. So, I've had like a lot of really good mentors or people I've worked for through the years that have just kind of like helped me learn, which is really good.
These days you have your own cafe called Saga. Tell us about how that came about.
So Saga came about probably through necessity. It had to happen eventually, I guess. I was at Hart's Yard, and I feel like the cakes were taking off. My kind of, I wouldn't call it celebrity, but like me being known was kind of taking off, and it got to the point where like me and Greg are great friends, but like I feel like it kind of started driving wedge between us because it was his restaurant, but people are kind of being like kind of mistaking it for me as opposed to him. The cakes were getting too much. I was having to make too many cakes. yeah, I feel like it just got to the point where, like, just through necessity, I had to leave. And I kind of had no idea what to do with myself because I had this kind of monster that I created, and I didn't think I was kind of ready to, like, kind of, I don't know whether I didn't want to do it by myself or whether I was scared to go out by myself because I didn't have someone there to fall back on. But I just kind of, went and spoke to a few, like I went and spoke to Michael, you know, I spoke to a few other people, had a few interviews to go work for some other people. And then I went over to have a chat to Donato over at Gelato Messina, and he basically just offered me, they just had this brand new factory, and he just said, do you reckon you can make it work if you just make cakes out of here? Like, you can come in after hours, you can use the space, order everything through us. And I was kind of like, because he basically was just like, you don't want to go work for somebody else. This is your time. Go do your thing. So, you know, I had a couple of offers on the table, which I turned down. I spent like two years and a half, just working out of the Messina factory, making the cakes. People would come and pick them up from there, doing events. It was crazy. And then from there, I think once again, out of necessity, out of like spending too much time with people, eventually I had to move on. I think the, hey, do you want to come here and make cakes for like, until you work out what you want to do, kind of got to the point where it's like, dude, it's time to leave home, you know? And then, yeah, I'd actually managed to save some money for once in my life back then, basically, because, I mean, when you own your own business, it's really great. You have all this money coming in and you're just like, oh my God, but then you don't realize that you haven't paid tax yet. So, you know, when you have a job, like your tax comes out every week, but when you're a sole trader, you pay your tax at the end of the year. So I was just paying myself a minimum salary and putting all the money aside. I was just like, I'm not touching that until I get a bill from the tax department. And anyway, after 2 years, I had enough money that I thought, you know, I can go set something up. Little did I know how much it actually cost to set up a restaurant, or like, you know. So Saga came about. It's not the most high tech kind of polished pastry shop in the world, but that's okay because that's not really the way that I do things. And I've kind of always, you know, Hearts Yard was always kind of a do it yourself thing, and you know. Yeah, I love it. I think it's like nearly 6 years now that we've been in Enmore. So we found the space and we looked at a few spaces, and like we looked at like kind of big empty hollow spaces, and then you'd get quotes for how much everything was going to cost. And you're just like, I just don't understand how all that costs that much money. It's absurd. And then we found that space. It was a meatball shop. Called Ballers, and yeah, we found it on Gumtree. We bought the space off the guy and kind of fitted out on our smaller budget and opened up from there, and we've been there but nearly 6 years now.
Tell us a bit about the offering that you created there. Were there challenges? It's such a busy street with so many different offerings on it.
Yeah, I think at the time when we first opened up, I mean, the only other pastry shop really in the area was kind of Black Star. And I think it kind of felt like, I don't know, this might sound stupid, but it kind of felt like a bit of a homecoming because, like, obviously me and Madison met at Hearts Yard and we'd always lived in the area and worked in the area. So, like, setting up the shop, you know, 200 meters from where it all kind of started, I felt was kind of nice. Back then, back then when we opened, it was crazy. Like, I think, I guess that was kind of like the height of my kind of popularity. So, like, you know, if that's what you want to call it, like, I feel like that's kind of like, yeah, when I was getting a bit of attention in the media and all that kind of stuff. So when I opened it up, it was kind of crazy. Like, for the first, you know, first 6 months, it was just relentless, and it was a massive challenge, like, going from, like, I guess, working solo to having a big team, because we were going through so much stuff, and I stupidly decided to take myself off the pastry section and do the savory section instead. I don't know why I did that, because cooking eggs and breakfast is probably one of the most unenjoyable shifts as a chef you could possibly ask for. So if anyone out there is listening and they're wondering why breakfast chefs are always look so miserable. yeah, I guess I learned a lot of things back then. Like, I just, there were certain points where I was just like, I'd finish a really busy breakfast lunch service and I kind of like look over at the pastry team, and I felt like I had a lot of pastry chefs. Like, I wasn't used to having this many pastry chefs, and I felt like I had a lot of them, and they were just kind of always in the shit. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, why am I still here at, like, you know, 8 o'clock at night doing prep for tomorrow? And yeah, in the end, like, I mean, I lost a couple of chefs really early on because of, like, I guess how intense it was and how busy it was. And, you know, you kind of like, well, we're opening, like, it's going to be busy for a while, but, like, people, so I lost a few chefs early on. And then eventually I just decided that, you know, I'm going to get a savory chef, and I'm going to go back there and see what the hell's going on, because I just don't understand what's going on. So I did that. And I guess once I stepped back there, I kind of saw what was going on, and worked it all out, and we actually didn't need half the chefs that I had. So, yeah, you just kind of like learn things throughout. Like, I guess at the start as well, I always had this perception that pastry shops made everything every day. Everything was fresh in the cabinet, and like at the end of the day, you threw all your stuff in the bin that you didn't sell. And then, like, I spoke to a few other pastry chefs who had their own pastry shops, and they're like, no, dude, you don't throw everything out at the end of the day. Like, you got to make product that kind of lasts. Like, there's certain things that, like, you do daily, but, like, then there's a certain range of stuff that, you know, can sit in the cabinet for 2 days. And I was like, oh, you're right. Makes sense now.
6 years is extraordinary. Has it changed a lot in that time?
Yeah, like, I mean, I always had this dream that, like, by the time I was 40, I'd be retired. stupid dream, didn't work out. I mean, I've still got time, but I don't see it. Don't see it happening. I mean, we obviously had the whole COVID thing. Which is a whole another kettle of fish. And I guess we did try and expand and open another shop. And just so happens that was, you know, 6 months before COVID. So that didn't ever eventuate into, like, we lost that shop pretty early on, which was a kind of a humbling experience, I guess. Like, I mean, I wouldn't say I don't get fazed by too much stuff, and like, I wouldn't say like I've had too many failures in my career up until now. I mean, apart from like not putting like mousse in cakes and stuff, but like, I guess when like you have a business and it's the first time that you realize it's something's not working, and you have to like be okay with, I guess, that sense of failure, which is kind of hard. I found it hard, but like, at the same time, it had to happen, because otherwise I would have lost Saga and Emora at the same time. If I'd been stubborn and just kind of, cause I mean, it was down in Darling Square. It was when the pandemic hit, and there was just no one around. So, and I mean, they wanted everyone to push on down there, but like at the end of the day, you can either keep pushing on and lose both your businesses, or you can, you know, cut one and move on from there and just accept it. I've definitely learned a lot of stuff along the way. Like, you know, there's certain tips, like how to run the place on a small team, like I had to do during COVID and all that kind of stuff. So you just learn how to adapt to things, like have products that use, you know, same base things and, yeah, things like that. Whereas, like, I guess back in the day, you know, back when I was a restaurant chef, you know, 5,000 things on a plate, no problems. But now you can't. Doing things, I guess the other thing is like creating dishes for yourself is a big thing that I had to learn as well. Like, I guess as a working in restaurants, you can kind of push people towards kind of weird combinations or somewhat weird combinations. But when you own a pastry shop and you have a different clientele and people just don't buy that kind of stuff. So like I'd be doing something that I thought was, which was delicious and I thought sounded really cool, but people would just come in and scrunch up their faces and you'd be standing there watching people scrunch their faces up at the cabinet and you're just like, oh man, that really hurts.
Let's talk about cakes. What makes a great cake?
What makes a great cake? Well, it's got to taste good. I feel like it's got to taste good. There's the dryness factor. You never want a dry cake. You never want to feel like you need to drink a glass of milk or drink a glass of water to get it down. I think it's just the flavor combinations of making it in kind of interesting, decadent, you know, different textures. I kind of like to approach the cake in kind of the same way I would like a plated dessert. Like, you know, you need different elements to kind of make a plated dessert interesting. Like you can't just have like a panna cotta with like some cream and stuff, like, because everything just tastes the same. Like you need to have, like, you know, some acid or just depending on what kind of flavor you're going for, but like you need to have like different textures and mouthfeels and kind of contrasting flavors to make it all interesting. And I guess how you put it together and how it eats is also really important as well.
Is there a cake that you've made over your career or more recently that you can sort of tell us about that sort of epitomizes sort of what you do?
That's a good question. I guess all the cakes kind of epitomize what I do. So they all kind of bank on some kind of nostalgia for me, like things that I've grown up with, whether they be flavors or things like for me, like my nan, things that my nan used to make used to be kind of like nostalgic for me. It's like, they're always my point of reference for desserts. I did make my own birthday cake once, and so that was kind of like all the things that I love in a dessert. Like I love like lemon meringue pies, I love cheesecakes, I love salted caramel. So I guess they kind of reflected what I'm about, I guess.
Can you tell us about this birthday cake that you made for yourself? You've made so many for other people, but I'd love to know what your cake was.
This was back in Hartsyard days that I came up with the Andy cake, and I was working and it was my birthday. So I decided that, just for shits and giggles that instead of pie of the week, I was going to make my own birthday cake and serve it to people with a candle on it and happy birthday written on the plate. it was like a cheesecake mousse. There was like a cocoa nib cake, a salted bourbon caramel, whole lemon curd, peanuts, just kind of all things that I kind of like to eat. Obviously it had meringue on it because that's what all my cakes have on them. And a milk crumb. It was good. No one ever orders it, really, so it's okay. Was it? It's on the menu. It's on the menu. You can order it if you want one for your birthday, but no one tends to order it, so I won't take offense to that. I kind of find it more annoying when people do order it because no one ever orders it, so it means I have to do a whole heap of prep that I usually don't have to do. So
you've had a fascinating career, and the impact that you've had is quite extraordinary, but what do you love about what you do?
I just love making food for people, and I love giving people food and seeing the reaction on their face. And you know, it's kind of like somebody feed Phil moment when like people eat stuff and they kind of like just get that stupid kind of little smile on their face and like a bit of a head nod, whether it be like pastries or sandwiches at Saga. Like I just like seeing people enjoy stuff, whether I'm like cooking for other people or my family at home. I often get a kick out of like Madison, my partner, like we'll go to Harris Farm after work and we'll have no idea what we're having for dinner, and then like I'll come up with something and she kind of like always scrunches her face up. She actually does this most times. I suggest something, like whether it be at the shop or at home for dinner, and I'll go home and I'll make it, or I'll go to work and I'll make this cake that I've been talking about in the car, and when I give it to her and she turns around and looks at me and she's just like, yeah, whatever, like she just gives me that like, you knew this was going to taste good, I hate you kind of like. Or I'll be sitting there on the couch like as I've given her dinner and she's had her first mouthful, and I kind of like look to the left and she can see that I'm like looking because she knows I'm looking for that, yeah, you're right. I just really love people's reactions when you cook, and like the idea of like sitting down and everyone enjoying themselves. And I guess like also love like kind of the getting people to try things that they wouldn't have tried, and the realization that like they actually enjoy stuff that they didn't think they would like. It's a, like another, like being able to, like you go overseas and you eat all these different foods and you post them on your Instagram and everyone's just like, that's gross, that's gross, that's gross. And then like, you know, I go overseas with my dad and then he's like, I'm not eating that, not eating that. But then you eventually convince him to eat it. And he's like, oh, that's actually really nice. And like, it's kind of nice being able to like have that experience of like being able to show people, like introduce all these things to people. Like I kind of like, Back in the day, like, you know, back in my mashed potato and chicken schnitzel days when I was, like, you know, growing up at school to, like, where I've come now, like, my appreciation of different foods and willingness to try stuff and realizing that, you know, all these things that I used to see growing up that I used probably would have just scrunched my nose up at it. Now I appreciate them and what they are, and it's really nice to be able to kind of show other people that, I guess.
Well, Andy, it's an absolute honor to have you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Will do. Cheers, mate.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.